Welcome to the Hope Podcast, a show about Harvard Divinity School students and how they find hope in difficult times. My name is Riley Brown, and I am a second-year Master's of Divinity candidate, a chaplain intern in the Office of Religious and Spiritual Life here at HDS, and I'll be the host of today's conversation. I'm joined by Keisha Bush, a second-year MTS student. Keisha, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Riley. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, thank you for making room in your busy schedule to come here and chat with me.
Absolutely.
So, I want to begin with having you introduce yourself a little bit to our audience. Where are you from? Do you follow or belong to a religious or spiritual tradition? Things of that nature.
I'm actually from Boston. So I was born here in Roxbury, and then I sort of grew up in Dorchester. And then my later years, Mattapan.
Okay.
I did flee Massachusetts, like many people do after undergrad, and went to New York. And so New York has been the city that has sort of, that has raised me into adulthood. And it's when I decided to go back to school for another master's that I Googled Harvard Divinity. I was like, does Harvard have a divinity school? I'm a novelist who also has a background in communications because I went to business school for undergrad, but a novelist and a teacher. I teach. I had been teaching for over 5 years part-time, like English 101 literature courses, and I'm here at the Divinity School for like a number of reasons, some practical. One, like, oh, I need health insurance. That would be very, very nice. The other was to, I know it sounds, hopefully it doesn't sound, bougie, but to hide out from the publishing industry because it's not a nice space for writers or for a lot of people. I mean, as a writer, you know, the industry is about fast money for products that take a really long time to produce.
Right.
And, you know, you and I had talked about this a little earlier, but unless you're coming from money, some kind of support system, It feels virtually impossible to create and pay bills and live.
Right.
And so as a writer, always looking for residencies and fellowships. And when I was thinking about another master's, you know, I wanted to focus on something that I was really interested in. I realized like, oh wait, I love religion. And I didn't realize that the theology degree also made space for literary.
Right. Yep.
You know, so my focus here at the Div School is religion, literature, and culture.
Yeah.
And it's been the most amazing experience and just literally exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
And I feel like we don't often experience exactly what we need in life. And I didn't know what my experience would be, what the classes would be like, but I just felt like this was the right space to be. And what I've been able to just discover and explore has just been so, this is the Div School, such a blessing. but yeah. So
good. I'm glad that it's great to hear that. I think some people, I know HDS is a lot of things to a lot of people, and I'm glad to hear that it has been exactly what you need in your own phrase. So that's very heartening to me. And I want to ask too, I moved to JP when I moved to Boston, which is kind of around your neck of the woods, it sounds like. I guess I just want to, did you ever have any idea of going to Harvard, living in Roxbury, and Did you say Dorchester?
Yep, Dorchester.
Yeah, because it's been a struggle for me to get to Harvard, like in terms of distance.
Yeah.
And I was just curious, yeah, growing up in Boston and in and around the kind of southern part, JP, Mattapan, you said.
No.
Harvard, yeah. Harvard,
no.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is my family used to make this trip for more than a decade. And we would, coming from Dorchester, because by then, you know, I'm like maybe 8 years old, you know, we would pass through, like, over by Commonwealth Ave, by BU,
yep.
And then come down, get to Memorial Drive.
Yep.
We would pass through here, so we had, you know, seeing the Harvard students all the time, and jump on Route 2 and go out. I don't know. Now you're going to see how American I am. I don't know what direction that is.
Neither do I. I don't even know where Route 2 is, if it makes you feel better.
I'm like, is Route 2 going north, west?
Yeah.
Who knows? I'm a New Englander.
Yeah.
That's all that matters. And so I grew up seeing these college students, and then I ended up going to Bentley. The Bentley shuttle is right here in Harvard Square. So that's how I would take the red line from, and by now my family's living in Mattapan.
Right.
I would take the red line from Ashmont over there.
Which is a long way.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then come here to Harvard Square and grab the Harvard shuttle over on Brattle Street.
Okay.
And then make it to Bentley. But again, and I'm always, so much of my life growing up was this sort of transitory action through Harvard Square, through Cambridge, and seeing Harvard students. And what's fascinating is, for me, it was like a world that I would, I just never thought I could, quote unquote, penetrate this world or somehow belong to it. And so I just never, maybe this is, you know, I guess little kids should have bigger dreams, but like, I was such a like pragmatist. I was like, you know, this isn't my world and that's okay. And you know, so I just never thought. So when I decided to apply, I remember when I first came to the website, I was like, oh, this is a really nice website. And it's like so informative and, you know, doing my research about the TIP school. And then there's videos, which are, I'm like, oh, this is such a heartwarming place. And then I went to, like, you know, Union Seminary, their website, and I went to Yale's, and I'm like, ooh, it just feels so cold. I feel so embraced.
Yeah, right.
By this amazing Harvard Divinity website that, like, puts a personality and really actually puts the people forward first.
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoever did this website deserves an honorary PhD. They probably already have one.
Go communication.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm like, this is genius. And so then I applied, and when I got in, I'll be honest, I didn't expect to get in. So I was like, oh my gosh, they made a mistake. I'm going to get a letter in like 3 days.
Yeah.
Telling me, dear Keisha Bush, we're so sorry to inform you.
Right.
That was a mistake of the algorithm. So this is just like, you know, what compelled me. I don't know. Maybe it was the Google algorithm.
Yeah.
But I, because it happened in such a sort of surprising is the word I like to use, like, oftentimes we love surprises. And so I love when I surprise myself. And that, for me, that makes it even more exciting.
Yeah. Well, you're here now.
I am.
You made it.
I am.
And you do belong here, which is great.
Yeah.
So having introduced yourself a little bit, could you give us a brief spiritual autobiography and state explicitly the religious tradition you belong to, if you belong to any, and the role that tradition has played in your life?
I very interestingly come from a pluralistic, the way I like to describe it is a pluralistic sort of religious background. So my family were practicing Jehovah's Witnesses. And then when I was around 8 years old, my mother converted to Islam because she divorced and got remarried. And my stepfather was Muslim. So through now my formative years, there was a almost like relearning of text and story and narrative. And then when I was about 16 or 17 years old, they had a rip. And I think it was, I was still kind of like sort of distant at that point. Like I'm in my teens, I'm working, I'm trying to get through high school. But they had, I think, a theological rip in their relationship. And my mother stopped attending the mosque. And because we were her children, we weren't going to the mosque anymore either. I was also in my teens and I was like, you people have no idea what you're doing. I'm so angry.
Right. Yep.
And so then I, a bit lost, ended up discovering Buddhism. And actually, the first tradition I was introduced to through a colleague was the Nichiren Daishonin, Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, the people who chant that. And so I was an active practitioner of that practice for about 4 years, but I was really, I questioned a lot. And so I had a theological sort of rip with that tradition in particular, because I, by then, have practiced very dedicatedly three different traditions that don't necessarily, that have overlaps but are not, you know, synergistic in a way that they are practiced. And so then I sort of was lost for about a year or two. I'm still in my 20s. And I end up finding a friend who introduced me to Theravada Buddhism, Vipassana, which is, you know, mindfulness. And I've practiced that ever since. And I think one of the things, and I'm in New York by now, and there is a very active Black Buddhist community in New York, New York City. And our teachers are very diverse, of all different races. And so are our members, too, of the place that I practiced, New York Insight Meditation Society. But what I found for me within that community was a pluralistic approach to faith. So although our teachers were teaching the Dharma, the Buddha, you know, his teachings, they would quote Jesus. They would quote poetry, Mary Oliver and Rumi. And we had people who were Muslim, but practicing Buddhism also, mindfulness, meditation. They brought, we would have teachers, like we could go, our space was very pretty at the time, very beautiful, and we rented it, and it was open to people of other faiths and within Buddhism. So I've had the opportunity to sit with and practice with Tibetan Buddhists. There was also Tibet House that I would go to, and also Zen monastics teaching I would attend. And so, although I am in the Theravada Vipassana tradition, my own practice is somewhat pluralistic itself. And it's so funny. I lived in West Africa, which is in Senegal, which is Muslim, like traditional, like 90, 95, 98% of the population. And it's so funny. So Christians think I'm Christian. especially like Black Christians, they're like, hey, you know, where's your church? And I'm like, ooh, right. I don't have a church. And they're like, oh my God, are you atheist? And I'm like, no. well, okay, I'm Buddhist. I practice Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And then Muslims are like, oh, you're still Muslim. And I was just like, yeah, you know, like, so everyone thinks I'm their favorite.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I love that because it means that we have a language.
Right.
Like, I have this pluralistic sort of religious language in which I can speak to people from different faiths.
Right.
And we can connect and see each other's humanity. And I think that, as kind of frustrated as a kid as I was with all the switching, I was also curious, too, as a kid. And that has given me something that is precious.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to call it, you know, but it's precious. And that was one of my, like, top interests also for coming back to Div School, because I feel like Divinity School is, like, communications.
Yeah.
You know, the School of Communications, a.k.a. Divinity. Because what we're able to do with our studies, with our research, is really learn additional languages or learn languages, the language of theology deeper, because theology sits in people's heart space. Right. And even people who are atheists, that is a belief system, you know, and to be able to recognize that. I think we're really lucky that we've found ourselves on this path.
Yeah.
It's really joyous.
And it's so interesting that you're so uniquely qualified to engage in interreligious dialogue.
Yeah.
Because as you say, you have all of this history that is so unique, especially to the American context, right? Despite being an American yourself, you have this history of predominantly not... or of not being a part of predominant religions in America, which is so, that's, like you say, such a blessing that I'm sure very frustrating, like you said, as a child, but at this point in your life, you're at such a place, and at HDS, you're in such a place that you can speak to so many, you can speak to so much, which is cool. And it's great, too, that you see that as a good thing, because I think a lot of people might see it as maybe a hindrance, or if, say, someone really bought in, given your background, then really bought into something else that wasn't as pluralistic, it would make them be more likely to say, like, oh, well, this is bad, and this is bad, and this is bad, whereas your tradition now has given you the perspective to appreciate all of the things that have, you know, molded you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So the central theme of this podcast is hope. But before we talk explicitly about what gives you hope, I was curious if you could talk about what I would call vehicles for hope, or something that Carrie told me, a nice illustration is, if hope is a seed, what tools do you use to cultivate the ground that you're planting your seed of hope in? Yeah, what are your vehicles for hope? What are your tools that give you strength? And these can be anything from insights or practices that you engage in regularly or whatever.
That's such a wonderful question, and I love Carrie's visual of it.
Yeah.
What are my tools? It's so funny. Years ago, I was on the phone with a family member. I won't out them. And they, very, not in a nice way, they go, everyone can't be as happy as you, Keisha. Mm. And I'm like, do you think that's easy?
Mm.
You know, you're so positive. It's not easy.
Yeah.
It is cultivated.
Mm.
Now I've learned this through experience. I play I do little experiments, or I conduct experiments with myself to see what the result will be. And one of the ways, right, how do I cultivate, or what are one of my tools for hope, is intention. So at one point, from, you know, I'm not supposed to quote unquote run. I have a limitation due to fused bones in my feet. But I was still running because I want to. Who doesn't want to do what other people can do, right?
Right.
You know, I'm human. So I learned to just go for one run a week. And I had all this knee pain. And I said, oh, what am I going to do about this knee pain? And so during one of my meditations, there's a loving kindness and like a metta meditation where you say, you know, may I be happy and at peace. May I be safe and protected from all harm. May I be healthy and have a strong body. May I have ease and joy in my life. And an additional one teacher taught me, is may I be free. Mm. Okay. You do it for yourself. You do it for people close to you. You do it for people that you have, like, a neutral relationship with that you never think about, like the male person or the bus driver. And then you do it for someone that's kind of difficult and then someone who's very difficult in your life. Okay. And I started to play around with this idea of language. And I said, what if I said, I am happy and at peace. Hmm. I am safe and protected from all harm. My knee does not have pain. And so.
As your knee's throbbing in pain.
Exactly. And I did that for like 2 weeks. And suddenly, the pain in my knee is completely gone. Mm. And later, I'm like, oh, you know, mind over matter. And then I go, wait a second. In those 2 weeks, I went and bought a pair of new sneakers that are better supportive of my feet. And that's where the source of my knee pain was coming from. And what I realize is oftentimes the intention that I put in the world, the thing that I speak, what happens is my unconscious, this is what I believe is happening, my unconscious is saying, okay, if our knee does not hurt, it's because we need to do something. What do we need to do? Oh, we need to go buy some new sneakers.
Right.
And so, you know, life, I approach life with a level of playfulness because it is kind of absurd in its own way. Like, all of this noise, all this chaos, the hurting one another, and all of, and it, for me, it just doesn't make sense. So what if I practice kindness? What if I practice listening? What if I practice patience? What happens if I say that I'm going to do these things, how will I shift? Mm. I discovered years ago, like so many other people, because this is a cultural thing, I put myself down. Mm. I call myself names. If I drop something and break it, you know, oh, Keisha, you're so, and I would use one of those words, you know? And I said to myself, what if I said, okay, this is what I'll do. I'll say the antonym to the word. So if I call myself, I now have to say out loud, oh, girl, you're so smart. Mm. And I started to do that. And I felt so corny. Calling myself smart. Calling myself, I don't know, beautiful, whatever it was, that I just stopped saying the negative word.
Right. Yeah.
And so because I began this new habit, now the habit was just don't call yourself the name at all. What I discovered was all this emotional space was freed up within me, because I wasn't harping down or punching down on myself. And a side effect of that is I had no need to punch down on anyone else. I basically lost the language of harm. Not to say that it doesn't crop up sometime. You're like, what's wrong?
But it's not an immediate response.
It's really not. And I can actually catch myself at this point. And so I didn't realize that not punching down on myself would change my approach to other people. And so what it ended up doing is opening up all this narrative space, all this emotional space, for me to fill it with something else. And I guess I went through this whole sort of little explanation to realize or to say that one of my tools of hope is language. Very intentional language. Like, and I think part of that came from Buddhism, because within the Buddhist community, they, you know, we were taught to say, not to call ourselves Buddhists, but to, you know, I practice Buddhism. So what is it to say that I practiced Buddhism, that I practice equity? And that's the other thing. You know, we live in a world where it's like, we're fighting for equality. We're fighting for freedom. We're fighting capitalism. And I'm like, fighting. What a word, right? I'm fighting for this. And so I'm, you know, I'm an activist. I started to say, what if I change my language and the way that I approach it? So what is a way to, what's another way to say that? And I realized I practice equity. I practice inclusion. I practice safety. And if I'm a practitioner of it, if I, by some intention or non-intention, cause harm, one, I try to forgive myself in that moment or at some point, but also in that forgiveness, also speak. And if it's somebody who's on the other end, I apologize. I didn't actually mean to do that. You know, I'm sorry. Even if it's days later, people are often like, oh, Keisha, I wasn't even thinking about that. Well, I was. You know? So, but I realized to do that, I had to not hold shame, because we're taught, especially in this country, we're all holding shame, and so often we don't even know where that shame comes from. It's been passed down to us or pushed on to us. So I guess that was a really long answer too. About
a very good answer, though, I'll say.
About language and intention. And if I'm looking at my own language and questioning my own language, that causes me to be silent. More often than not. So then I'm also listening and thinking.
And I think what you said, speaking from my own tradition, the importance of the way you view yourself affects the way you view others. I struggled with that for a long time in the Christian tradition, of which I'm a part. Some strands say basically, in different words, obviously, but they'll say, God hates you. And I never realized that totally colored how I saw other people. Because if God hates me, God hates everyone else too. And why should I be kind? That's just something that has taken some theological work on my end, but it's so true. This kind of vertical relationship, whether that's with yourself and, you know, something that you see to be higher, or just how you view yourself within yourself, totally affects how you interact with others in the world. So I think that is a truism across all things. But thank you for such a good answer. So now, to state it plainly, what would you say gives you hope?
Hope is such a... Hope is what has allowed... I think about this. I believe hope is what has allowed humanity to continue, right? And to evolve and to expand. And without it, it's almost as if we're lost in the dark matter in the universe, right? So hope keeps us tethered to right now. It keeps us tethered to one another. And, you know, we are struggling with isolation and loneliness is a big thing that has been in the sort of public narrative for a while now. And one of the ways that I actually keep hope have been able, and we have such a great example, right? Since 2020, the world is so tumultuous. Yeah. You know, the pandemic, killer bugs at one point, you know, like, yep. You're like, oh my
God. Weird times.
Exactly. Every single Delta, Omicron, like, you know. And then the political unrest across globally. And we ask ourselves, like, it looks hopeless,
right. Yeah.
Quite frankly. So how do we hold on to hope? And for me, it has been community. Mm. You know, I know here at the Div School, I've noticed people are, like, uncomfortable with the word network.
Right.
They use network in business,
yeah.
The law school.
Yeah.
You have to network.
Yeah.
And I've changed that word to community.
Mm.
You have people in your community that you don't talk to every day, but they're still part of your community.
Right.
You know, your postman, the man, the family that owns the store, you know, the local store, the hardware store, your neighbors, your place of faith is part of your community. And... when a community supports one another and is interested in the health of the community, I believe that, and I have been able to embrace and hold on to hope through this time. It's not to say that hope hasn't been challenged, because it has. There have been times where I was feeling hopeless and I realized, let me call a friend. Let's go for a walk, right? Tell me what's going on in your life. And reconnecting with, you know, New York has been home for me, even though I was born here in Massachusetts. And so when I go back to the city, that's what we call it, you know, I reach out to my friends. A perfect example is before I did my MFA, my first master's, I would give 2 parties a year, like house parties. Mm. My birthday and Christmas, like the December time.
Okay.
So it was a holiday party. So therefore it was inclusive. It didn't matter what your background was.
Right.
Let's have food and just get together. And my part in these get-togethers, these house parties, I had people as young as, I was actually a big sister to a young 16-year-old girl in East New York. So she was able to, like, bring her friend, and it was so fancy for her because she's, like, hanging out with these adults, all the way up to, you know, people within my community who were, like, in their 70s and 80s.
Mm.
And I love this multi-generational, multi-background, I remember some friends coming and they're like, what is this? The United Nations, Keisha? You know, you have everyone from so many different countries and backgrounds. And I'm like, yes. And someone told me one day, and it was at that party, they said, at this one particular one, I know your politics. And I was like, oh, well, I never really thought about it like that. These are just friends. So for me, community has been number one, practice and ritual. You know, whether it's prayer or meditation, but something to, and I think prayer and meditation belong in the, are in the same family, you know, in grounding oneself, nature, you know, like I love animals. At the time, I would feed the birds because I had that opportunity. Well, also, I had a possum. I named her Patricia. There was Rascal Ronnie the raccoon.
Did you have a pet raccoon, or that the raccoon was just around?
He was around.
Okay. But you had the pet possum.
Actually, she was around
also. Oh, she was just around too. Okay.
They're all wild.
Okay. Okay.
And I had adopted two stray cats. They didn't live with me because they weren't interested in that. But there was Casanova because all the ladies fed him in the neighborhood.
Great name for a cat.
Exactly. And his girlfriend, Lily, who is very, what is that word when they're really...
Like feisty?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And she would tear everybody up. Anyway. So like being part of the world around me, you know, and recognizing, so the beauty of life, with the trees, the animals, my neighbors, even neighbors who, at first chance thought maybe I didn't agree with them. I was living in Oklahoma at one point during, this is where I had all the animals. Mm-hmm. And my neighbor across the street, he was so funny. Somebody stole his package one day. And so I came out and I was like, I think I, you know, it might have been these people who like do drugs. And they had left the box of the stuff. And so he goes, well, if I was home, I would have got my gun and came out. And I was like, well, you know what? You defend yourself. And he knew I was like from New York. Mm-hmm. And he's like, and he looked at me and I'm like, look, I don't believe in people stealing each other's stuff. And when I was moving, his name was Jared. When I was moving, I was just like, yeah, I'm moving. I'm going back east. And I was like, Jared, just to let you know, I felt so much safer. Because you were my neighbor across the street. Mm. Like, he was just so nice. And also, like, if anything went down, and I'm not pro-violence, but if anything went down, he had a gun.
Jared would protect you.
Jared would. And I was just, and he laughed. And I just, you know, like, I love when we surprise each other. You know, my politics, I think our politics were different, mm-hmm. right? But it doesn't mean that we can't be neighbors, that we can't be friends, that we can't look out for each other, and that we can't have jokes.
Right.
And also, I think for me, one of the things that I specifically decided, I try to be intentional, is to tell people how I feel mm-hmm. about them. And I'm much more forward with that. Like, I appreciate you. You made me feel more safe, which he actually did,
yeah.
You know, without ever knowing. And if I never said that to him, he would have never known that.
Right.
You know, you look really nice today. I love your hat. And it doesn't cost me anything right. to do these things. And so this intention and not to be afraid, I realized that to be vulnerable, I have to practice courage. And to practice courage is to admit that I'm afraid. Mm. And that's okay. And so one day, it was like 2016, I was in my apartment in Harlem, 2 a.m., in my room by myself, and I said, I'm going to practice more vulnerability. And then I said, what does that even look like? I have no idea. But I'm like, it's my intention. So I'm a huge, clearly, fan of stating intentions, a huge fan of being intentional about my language, a huge supporter of building community. And that doesn't mean that, like, oh, my community is like 1,000 people because I have like 50,000 friends. I really don't. But I appreciate people, and I think people and humans and animals, I think everyone's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I'm still like in awe of our existence because it's fascinating.
It's important too.
It is. Yeah. It is. So let me see, what else do I do for hope? Being active is one of the ways that I've really have been able to foster that. And being honest with myself, like, how am I feeling? One of my big things is asking for help when I need it. Mm. That has been huge for me. And it has fostered hope in a way that I didn't realize was so important.
Yeah.
Because when I ask for help, I'm not leaving myself isolated to fall down
into hopelessness.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm like, oh, please.
Right, right, yeah. And there's always somebody. Right?
There is. Yeah. There is. Yeah. Look, that mailman, the family on the that runs the store, yep. You know, we're all part of this. And when you are able to recognize how beautiful and important other people are, I find that they've returned it to me in ways that I didn't even expect.
Right. I would say, personally, too, I've also, ways that I wouldn't have expected and also ways that I feel like I wouldn't have deserved.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always, I've found, too, that there's always someone willing to lend a hand. Well, thank you so much for sharing. But before I let you go, I wanted to ask real quickly if you had any parting wisdom by way of recommendation. Is there a practice, podcast, book, movie, or whatever else you might recommend to listeners who need a little hope?
Okay. I was talking to some colleagues the other day, and I said, I actually don't have a very loud voice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for the last 2 years, I've been the MC for this conference here at Harvard through my organization over at the Chan School. And one of my favorite movies is Bridget Jones's Diary. This movie is so silly, but also so funny. And I don't know, maybe it's just this funny woman who's down on her luck. Where, and I think what it is laughter.
Mm.
The ability to laugh. And if I'm feeling so down, I will find something to make me laugh. So Bridget Jones's Diary makes me laugh. In terms of like books or podcasts, well, laughter is one, so funny movies, like Boss Baby. When I saw that, I was just like, I love the Minions. Like, I'm in the silly space, right? When it's just like, just laugh. Release those endorphins. And I guess, yeah, I'm wondering, good books to fall into. You know what was so interesting? And I'm not really into like the big self-help, but like The Power of Now was a really interesting book for me to read. It was very repetitive, which actually aggravated me. But then by the time I got to the end of the book, I'm like, oh, that's why it's very repetitive. It's trying to get you to just focus on the right now.
Yeah.
But Yeah, I guess. I know it feels oversimplified that I don't have some book that's like, it's going to be the thing. But finding opportunities to keep laughter in my life.
Whether that be a movie or a podcast or a book.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you for the recommendations and thank you for joining me, Keisha. This was so great.
Thank you so much, Riley. This has been amazing.
That is it. We did it.
That's awesome.
Thank you so much. That was so, that was great.